So I wanted to, you know, get more involved with the writing community in New York outside of just
comedy.
It's
like a really perfect screenplay. It's like, movies have budget. Let a real comedy writer have a pass at the comedy. Action, coming-of-age genre, Ben, sometimes from the 80s, sometimes referred to as the go-for-it genre.
Anything that we want to talk about is the craft.
Took out all the stakes for me, and nobody really dies at a low point. In a thriller, somebody's supposed to...
It was a lot more earned than it was in this.
The Soderbergh question. Process. What's more interesting? Thriller stakes or the actual process of things
being... I wish there were more films like this in the theater.
This is The Script, Episode 5. On today's podcast, we review the screenplay for Only God Forgives by Nicholas Winding Refn. Then we have a tracking board update with the latest spec script sales. We give an intro to our podcast Beat Sheet Editions by demystifying the screenplay's structural midpoint. The Baron scores an interview with Tina Fey to give her some career advice. And finally, we have a discussion on writing for television where we define TV formats and television genres and try to put the term dramedy to death. All right, let's get started.
When I was pregnant with you, it was strange. You were different. They wanted me to terminate, but I wouldn't. They don't understand you. And I never will.
The sound of Muay Thai boxing, the art of eight limbs. Thrust and move, feet shuffling across the ring. Fade in, interior back room night, close on a pair of hands from various angles. The sounds of the fighting grow louder, punches, kicks, elbows. The hands tense into fists, they're strong hands, fighter's hands. Zoom out to reveal Julian, mid-30s, staring at his hands. Even though he's kept in shape, he hasn't fought for a long time. The sound of the boxing mats gets louder still as Julian continues staring at his hands. It's almost as if he's meditating. Suddenly, he breathes in. Behind him sits a young kid dressed in Thai boxing clothes. This is Liang, barely 16. He looks nervous, occasionally glancing at Julian's reflection through the huge mirror that hangs on the wall. Julian continues to stare at his hands and closes them into a tight fist. Cut to interior corridors, night. The sounds of the boxing mats reach fever pitch as we track with Julian and Liang making their way towards the ring. Cut to interior Thai boxing ring, night. Two young Thai boxers beat the crap out of each other. The crowd is wild with excitement, people placing bets on which way the fight will turn. One of the Thai boxers goes down, and money immediately starts changing hands. The ring is cleared, and Liang jumps in as Julian pushes his way through that crowd, nodding at people as he passes. They know him here. Again, bets are placed. Pick out a face in the crowd, Billy, Julian's older brother, late 30s. Julian sits down next to Billy, who's delighted to see him, throwing his arm around him, pulling him in close. I love violence. Billy offers Julian a hit from his bottle of Mekong whiskey. Julian refuses. He's more interested in the fight. Back to the ring, where the fight has just started. Liang is immediately on the ropes. Julian watches, concerned. Billion takes out a phone call, but he can't hear. He nods to Julian and takes it outside. Back to the fight, where Liang pulls an amazing move, turns the tables, takes the bigger man down with a series of jabs, swings, and back fists. As Julian applauds Liang's success, Billy slinks out of the auditorium. Liang wins the fight with a knockout. The crowd goes wild with adulation. Julian watches, transfixed. Liang is lit up by a beatific white light. As he stands triumphant in the middle of the ring, the crowd start to gather around him. Julian continues to stare at what's taking place before him, which is almost like a religious ceremony. The audience bow down before Liang as he stares out into the light. A look of calm washing over his face, a sense of stillness and peace, enlightenment through victory and violence. All right, this is The Script. David Negrin, Mike DeLuca, we're doing Only God Forgives. Welcome, Mike, how you doing?
Good. Let's take a step right into hell.
Take a step right into hell. I mean, you can just, this script, you can taste the violence, and it tastes like adrenaline and blood in your mouth, you know? It's like phenomenal. This is a very exciting script, okay? The filmmaker and the writer and the director of the upcoming film is Nicholas Winding Refn, okay? Danish filmmaker, he had this Pusher trilogy that came out. It was his first three movies. That explored the criminal underworld of Copenhagen, and he launched Mads Mikkelsen's career in them. Later, he wrote and directed Bronson. It starred Tom Hardy and brought him to Chris Nolan's attention. Winding Refn directed Drive in 2011. Also, a neo-noir crime drama starring Ryan Gosling, where Refn received a Best Director Award at Cannes. Only God Forgives is adapted from the 2005 James Salas novel of the same name with a screenplay. No, excuse me. Drive was adapted from the James Salas novel of the same name with a screenplay by Jose Amini. We're big fans of Drive here. Amini pitched the script as a kind of, for Drive, as a kind of Alain Delon in Le Samurai, with the idea of the character not speaking at all. But then when the industry, the studio got a hold of it, they said, no, it has to be more of a straightforward thing. More dialogue got added, more action, more about the driver, and you know, his more like an action movie, like you know, Fast and Furious 6 or whatever. But then when Riffin and Gosling get involved, right, they went back to that idea of silence. I think that was important. The idea of silence from Drive is relevant in Only God Forgives. There's a lot in this screenplay that's setting up moments of dramatic silence where we see not just what people say, but people's reactions to it.
Well, definitely the Drive comparisons are there, but I think this is the anti-Drive. I think that on a superficial level, it resembles Drive. You've got the monosyllables in terms of the dialogue. You've got a slick soundtrack involving well-known pop culture hits. In this case, country music, Johnny Cash, Dolly Parton. But at the same time, I think this is his Mean Streets.
Oh?
This is his Descent into Hell. This is a movie about men whose only form of expression is violence. And their twin obsessions are salvation and damnation. This is Harvey Keitel holding his hand over the flame, an image that is echoed within the screenplay.
Yes.
Contemplating damnation. And he asks this character, this figure known as Chang, who hangs around the periphery of the story haunting him, calls himself the Angel of Vengeance. He, this cop who wakes up from a coma. And I think it's no coincidence that the third movie in the Pusher trilogy is called I'm the Angel of Death.
There's a lot of imagery in this screenplay that I'm sure we'll see in the film of angels and God and heaven, but no imagery of devils. You know why? Because these characters embody all the devils, okay? And their actions. There's plenty of devil in here. We don't need any of the extra imagery to do it. You get a real nice feel very quickly in this script for the underworld of Bangkok and Thailand and Thai kickboxing. Right, it's set up really well, like, because that's all these characters are. You know, they're all fighters or ex-fighters, and you know, they're just that's the world we're living in, and that's the underworld we're living in. And we find out later that Julian, the main character, is part of the London underworld, a crime family in London, but he's been expelled because they got into some trouble there, and he is looking after his troublesome brother here in Bangkok. So it's, in a way, it's Romeo and Juliet of like. Of crime worlds, like, because there is a bit of like a respect and a love story between Chang and Julian. They get each other. Chang is this angel of vengeance, and Julian at one point, and he actually says, it's what I want to be, or my whole life I've been trying to figure out, but that's what I want to be. I want to be the thing that brings karma back to the world, that sets things straight when they're out of line. I don't know. We're getting really philosophical on this one, Mike.
This is about a mystical quest.
Yeah.
In a karaoke hell.
Yeah. I mean, basic summary, right? Do we do a basic summary on this show? I don't know.
Why not?
I mean, you know, we meet Julian is an ex Muay Thai kickboxer. Now he's managing some. He has a brother who is trouble. Drinks, likes to beat women, and his brother one night ends up killing a Thai hooker.
Underage
Thai hooker. Yeah, she's 15, and so it's an unforgivable crime, right? And the police officer who's put in charge of the investigation is Chang, and he's not even a police officer anymore. They just called him in because it was an extra brutal murder of an underage girl. And so instead of doing the regular the regular police person's job of investigating the murder, because the brother's still sitting there. He's never leaves. He's methed out in the corner, right? They have, instead of arresting him, taking him down to the police, he goes and he gets the father of the young girl, right? And he locks him in a room and he says, do whatever you want.
And then we get to the classic Refn trope, the head caving. From Valhalla to Rising to Drive, you always have a head caving when you've got Refn.
Yeah.
But it's what happens afterward that's interesting, I think. He meets out vengeance on Billy. Caves his head in.
The brother.
Yes, the brother. And then afterwards, Chang takes him away.
Chang takes the father away.
Takes the father away and says, well, before he murders Billy, he says, what are you going to do? How could you let this happen to your daughter, who you know is walking the streets at night? And then he takes him away, and so he never forgets what happened and his own culpability and what happened to his daughter. He has his arm chopped off with an axe.
By Chang. Right, so there's he's restoring karma at multiple levels.
Yes.
Billy had to die by the hand of the
yes.
of the father of the girl he murdered, and the father had to take responsibility for letting his daughter, because he has other daughters.
Yes, he does. Yeah.
Out on the street, right?
Yeah.
And so he loses an arm, and so karma is returned somehow by the angel of vengeance. Only trouble is this: is that Julian has a mother, a vengeful mother, who is the true antagonist of this movie, Jenna. Right?
Yeah.
And she comes to town because Billy has to call her and tell her, that Julian has to call her and tell her Billy's dead. And we have Jenna, who's this iron fist of a crime family matriarch, says, whoever killed him has to die. Whoever's involved in the killing has to die. And Julian, once he finds Chang, finds he's the angel of death, and gets a moment of sort of spiritual connection with him, realizes that first of all, the father who killed Billy, you know, Billy had it coming, so he doesn't want to kill the father, but he does blame Chang to some degree, but he doesn't want to kill him either. Instead, he wants to challenge him to a Muay Thai kickboxing match. That's how the karma will be restored between them. They have this great set piece in the middle of the film. It's between our two main characters. I don't even know who's protagonist in this. I'm rooting for both guys. I'm rooting for Chang. I'm rooting for Julian. Both of these guys are great. The real antagonist is Jenna, who, you know, they have this great Muay Thai kickboxing fight set piece in the middle. What did you think of that?
I thought it was brutal, but it's also, I remember in the movie Barton Fink turns in this boxing screenplay at the end of the movie, mm-hmm. which is definitely not what the studio wants, and it turns out to be a man wrestling his soul, and that character, the producer played by Michael Lerner, has got a lot of colorful things to describe it, but basically that's what we're watching, two men wrestling with their souls in a kickboxing match.
Yeah, I mean, some of the way this is written in the script is extremely well done. I mean, some of the best fighting and dialogue in a violent sort of action script since the first 20 minutes of Red Belt by David Mamet. The rest of that film is not so good, but the first 20 minutes are amazing. Everybody should watch that. Problem is, the fight leaves Julian unsatisfied to some degree, and Jenna's unsatisfied completely. So she has her goons kill the father and take a crack at killing Chang himself, right?
Yeah.
And Julian, because he's unresolved from the fight, which he loses, takes it upon himself to get vengeance on Chang, not by killing him, but by killing his true love, his karaoke singing, duet singing wife. And so now, karma must be restored. And although Julian does allow his daughter to live and bows to the daughter at one point, for killing the daughter's mother. He's like a little girl, he decides to bow to her. It's amazing shit, it's like samurai shit. And so the karma now is a problem because Chang's wife is dead. And it must be restored.
Again, Refn seems to be fascinated by the same violent acts. We have a head caving and also a shotgun blast to the head, which mm-hmm. is oddly reminiscent of when Joan from Mad Men gets taken out in Drive. But What's interesting to me about the match itself is he chooses to lose at a certain point.
Does he?
He gives
up. I didn't understand that fully. Julian gives up or?
Yeah, because he realizes, I think at a certain point he finds whatever he's looking for in terms of peace, and he just, I think also partially despite his mother, frankly,
yeah,
whose main weapon is not guns, it's emotional manipulation.
And he has a moment where he's beating Chang, and because Chang has a kryptonite, he has a vulnerability. Apparently, he had a brain injury that stopped him from fighting. And if he gets hit in the head, Chang, even the Angel of Vengeance, who was in a coma for a year, could be killed. And so, yeah, I thought that was a little confusing for me because I was trying to figure out what's the low point of the movie and I had a question mark. Julian decides to lose, but then why does he have to go kill his wife after? Why does he have to kill Chang's wife?
Because Lady Macbeth, mom, puts the hooks back into him and offers him those little morsels of love that she's been denying all these years. And she just reels him right back into the point where he's willing to shoot a woman with a shotgun.
Yeah. The Jenna is played by who in the film? Kristen Scott Thomas. She's amazing.
Yes.
Okay, I saw her in The Seagull playing a very similar role. The female lead in The Seagull is like this vengeful, evil woman who's so dark. It's like there's nothing that can raise her back out of this hell. There's no goodness in her at all. And so she's the force. Yeah, she offers him these morsels of love. He does want his mother's love, but he's scared of her too. And so how does the film end how does karma finally restored?
Chang takes him, cuts off his hands. He can no longer fight.
He can no longer fight.
And the last image is Chang meeting his daughter, the two of them achieving a sort of peace.
Yeah. The Chang and the daughter have a peaceful moment playing with the toys, right? And Julian dismembered. Dismemberment, again, is another visual part of the image system that Refn likes to use. There's dismemberment in Drive as well in his previous movies. These guys didn't want to be enemies. That's what's so tragic about this. Both of these guys are spiritual, like Kemosabes, you know? But they're thrown into, and that's why this is great screenwriting, is because it's an immovable force. Right, or an unstoppable force hits an immovable object, right? So it's like, I don't know, it's great conflict. You're rooting for both guys, right? And then unfortunately the tragic piece is this mother, Jenna. What else do you have on this?
Well, it's very interesting to me that Refn was actually lived in the United States since like he was 11 years old for the most part. And the film that gave him his massive epiphany was the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yes. Because he saw that and he said, I want to direct. I want to control all, I want to control the, you know, the cinematography, the sound, everything, unique visions, you know, singular vision. And you get that. I mean, his style is very obvious here. I heard Only God Forgives didn't get a great reception at Cannes. Or it was mixed. There was applause, like strict, like, you know, very strong applause, and there were boos as well.
People were expecting Drive 2, I think, because of the teaming of him and Gosling. But you take out Carey Mulligan, you take out that groovy synth pop soundtrack,
right,
and you have Johnny Cash sung karaoke style by Chang.
Much darker.
Saying we're going to fall through that ring of fire, and that's what happens.
Yeah, there's no happy ending here.
Yeah.
There's really no happy ending here.
Love is a burning thing when hearts like ours sing. Those hearts are not Chang and his wife. They are Chang and Julian. And whoever plays Chang is going to be a superstar after this. I think it's going to be a star-making performance. Hopefully he'll have a longer lasting push than Getty Watanabe got with Last Samurai, but I hope for the best whoever plays Chang, because it's the role of a lifetime.
Tremendous. All right, Mike, thank you very much.
Welcome.
Welcome, readers. This is your tracking board update for July of 2013. This is your tracking board czar, Mike, offering you a taste of the treasures you will find at the website The Tracking Board, which I assure you is five flavors of awesome. So what have I been up to this July? Well, I took a job omen style as a satanic nanny to Kanye and Kim's newest offspring, as I felt that the Prince of Darkness would be a far better role model. I unfortunately was able to stop the child from getting a name beginning with K. My bad. I got laid at Downton Abbey. What can I say? Maggie Smith and I, we go way back. She's frisky, but I did not get the best of Miss Jean Brody. And I learned a valuable lesson. Never ask a hooker for a Pacific Rim job. How was I supposed to know she had tentacles? Honestly, give me a break. All right, moving on to scripts that have sold. Spec Sales. Morphine by Michael Kospaya. Logline. A teen diagnosed as unable to feel physical pain seeks out a dominatrix on his 18th birthday, and the two become entwined in a fight for their lives. Honestly, this is this kid's 18th birthday and he's only got one dominatrix? What the hell?
I want at least two or three.
Exactly. Two, three, four, even five.
Especially
I
can't feel it.
Exactly. All right, moving on. By the way, the dominatrix's name, Agony. Make of that what you will. The producer's name is Alexander Arai, the production company's Pathfinder Pictures, and the writer's represented by Babs Batella of the Silver Batella Agency. He's also the writer of 2013's The Suicide Theory, another macabre comedy. But right near, we've got The Sessions Meets Risky Business. All right, moving on. A Seat in Hell by Sam Celia. Logline. Bored with life. Traveling the world. A dying medical examiner attempts to quench his thirst for exploration by vicariously traveling through hell via tales told by the executed death rowers he secretly revives, pitched as Flatliners meets Black Swan. Which is great, as it's always been my great sexual fantasy to see Kevin Bacon in a tutu. If you can make that happen, world, make it happen. But seriously, folks, this script was a semi-finalist in the Tracking Board's Launch Pad competition of 2013 and the winner of its Dark Factory Entertainment Prize, meaning that the horror production company, The Dark Factory, has given this guy a production deal, this unrepresented writer, based on the strength of his work. Moving on. Also, the Launch Pad competition's finalist, Tranquility Base, by Daniel Turkowitz. Logline. When a global disaster strikes Earth, 15 astronauts fight to secure a spot in a moon base, only designed to support six. The previously unknown Turkowitz was signed to Energy Entertainment by Brooklyn Weaver based on the strength of his script. Brooklyn Weaver, for mid-six figures, managed to sell the script to Ridley Scott's Scott-Free Productions. So hopefully the script won't be rewritten by Damon Lindelof, which also happens to be the name of my punk ska band. Lastly, we have a script sale of Resistance 2 video game writer TJ Fixman's action comedy The Lost. Logline, reformed first-time offenders clear their names after they're framed for the murder of their parole officer. I can hear the movie guy's voice in my head. In a world where 48 hours never existed, in a land where Midnight Run was never made. It was recently sold to New Line Cinema. Sean Levy's attached as a producer, make of that what you will. Writers rep by Philip Raskin and Simon Faber at William Morris Endeavor. And he's managed by Jeffrey Silver at Fourth Floor Management. Until next time, this is your tracking board czar, Mike DeLuca, saying, I'll see you at Swizz or whatever venue our next collective meeting is, and buy me a drink.
All right, so this segment, we're gonna do the script beat sheet edition sampler. We just wanna advertise. The script beat sheet edition is a companion to the script main podcast. The script main podcast is monthly right now, but we've been doing beat sheet editions, kind of weekly or every other week, when great movies that we see, we want Chris Durham and I want to talk about.
Yeah. And hopefully a guest when we can get one.
Right. Yeah. And a guest. We try to get guests. We try to get like people who don't know screenwriting or people who don't know the Blake Snyder beat sheet. Like, in the BSE, our script doctors, don't analyze a script, but we instead see a major film in the theater and analyze its story in terms of the Blake Snyder beat sheet from the classic screenwriting text, Save the Cat. Our beat sheet explanations and samples are available on the website.
Yep.
Chris, let me just start by talking about, because what we want to do today is pick one particular beat from the Save the Cat beat sheet.
Of which there are 15. Right?
Of which there are 15.
Again. So we're going to pick the trickiest one.
The hardest one, which is the midpoint.
Yeah. This is, and you know what, whether you go by Save the Cat or whether you go by any other thing or just watching movies or just writing movies without knowing anything, the midpoint is always going to be your hardest thing.
Yes. In writing a screenplay, the midpoint is the key. It really is the key. If you can work it out, yes, your breaking a two is an important plot point, and your breaking a three is an important plot point, but the midpoint is what gets your clothesline hung properly so that the whole film falls together.
So what are the hallmarks of
So the midpoint is the largest plot twist of the film. It raises the stakes of the main character's goal. It can change the main character's goal completely, or at least make the requirements of the goal much more difficult. It can feel like a new movie is starting as a result of the midpoint.
Absolutely.
Here at the midpoint, the main character must recommit to the new goal for where there is no turning back, right? There's no turning back up to the midpoint.
Yeah, point of no return is a good way of framing it.
Right. Often the B story incites the midpoint plot twist. Often a ticking time clock for resolving the new goal begins ticking at the midpoint.
Yes. Stakes are raised.
Yeah.
It's often represented by a false success or a false failure on the part of the protagonist.
Yeah, you know, I get really confused about the false victory, false failure thing, because in almost all movies it's a false victory. Okay, so I mean it's so hard to find when there's like the midpoint is this false defeat. It's only in like comedies or something.
Well,
no, like
we
that.
We did one last week, man. I think we did White House Down, and I think it's a false defeat there. But
let's not. I think it's confusing. I think there's a lot better things we talk about when we're trying to define the midpoint.
So let's talk about a classic movie.
Okay, let's. Okay, what we're gonna do today is we're gonna take the midpoints from our last two beat sheet editions that had strong midpoints and analyze those, and then analyze a classic movie. We're gonna do Superman, the new Superman movie.
Man of Steel.
And we're gonna do Star Trek Into Darkness, and then we're gonna do The Wizard of Oz.
Yes.
Or should we do them in a different order?
You know what, let's do Wizard of Oz first. That way we set up, because I think this is a classic, this is a by the book kind of midpoint.
And you know what, midpoints are best, the best way to talk about them is in terms of the A story. What's the A story for The Wizard of Oz for Dorothy?
The A story is Dorothy on her mission to get home.
Okay. And she begins the first half of this story. The goal for her is to do what?
Is to go find the great, powerful, benevolent Wizard of Oz.
Right. So the first half of the second act is the Yellow Brick Road, meeting some obstacles.
Yeah. Meeting some obstacles, meeting some friends. This is her B
friends,
story,
right? Our B story is who?
It is her three friends, right? The lion, the
Cowardly Lion, the Tin Man, and the Scarecrow.
Right, and they're, that's classic B story too, because that mirrors what she wants. They're all on their way to the Wizard of Oz because he's going to give them brains, courage, a heart, right?
And get her home.
Right.
So the midpoint is when?
The midpoint is when they arrive at the Emerald City and find out that the Wizard of Oz is not quite so benevolent.
Right. And it doesn't just give people things they want.
Right. She's got to do something for him. She's got to scratch his back before he'll send her home. And with the B story too.
Yes. He won't give the courage. He won't give the heart, and he won't give the brain until they get the Wicked Witch's broom.
Right.
Right.
So this changes the dynamic of the story.
Okay. Much harder. The stakes have been raised. Now it's not just getting to the wizard. Now you have to go to the scariest person in all Oz, and she's got an army and she's got a castle. You have to get her broom and bring it back to him.
Yes.
To get all these things.
Right.
So the stakes have been raised. It's almost a different story now completely.
Yep.
Not exactly a ticking time clock, but...
No, but that doesn't always have to be there.
Yeah, that's more of a modern thing.
Right.
The B story crosses, like you said, because it involves the Scarecrow and the Lion and the Tin Man. They have to go with her.
Sure.
Classic.
Happens
midpoint.
Right in the middle, right?
Happens right in the middle, yeah.
And again, like it's, like I said, it changes the movie. Before, it was this kind of, you know, let's stroll down the road to get our reward. And now it's like, no, we got to go out.
In terms of Blake Snyder's beat sheet, you know, the first half of the second act is called Fun and Games. The second half after the midpoint is called Bad Guys Close In, okay?
Sure.
It's not Fun and Games anymore.
Right.
It's Bad Guys Closing In. There's a lot of higher obstacles.
And, you know, in the Fun and Games, we did have some bad guy, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we had the witch doing some stuff, but, you know, it's not at the same level as you've got to go into the belly of the beast. You've got to go to the witch's castle and get her broom now. That's
awesome.
That's a totally different game.
Awesome. Okay, so we did a script, we did a Beat Sheet Edition podcast on let me just do Man of Steel first.
Sure.
On Man of Steel. What's the A story for Man of Steel?
The A story.
Kal-El.
Kal-El. Becoming Superman. Right?
He's got to find out where he's from.
And where he fits in to Earth.
Right. He falls to Earth. He won't choose to be, he won't embrace his superpowers until he finds out where he's from.
Right. In fact, he's been programmed against it. His dad has told him.
Right, and his dad has told him,
to keep it
quiet.
Yep.
So the first half of the second act, he's learning to find himself.
Yes.
And at some point, he actually, even before the midpoint, he finds this ship that has the history of his world on it. It mm-hmm. even has his cape. And then he steps into the cape. He gets to speak with a holographic version of his father. He puts on the Superman suit and he starts learning to fly. So
right.
he's starting to embrace who he is.
The
stakes are, who am I and my powers, whatever.
Right.
What happens in the midpoint?
Midpoint, essentially what you do is you say, all right, you know who you are now, what are you going to do about it? Right. And the way that happens is General Zod arrives at Earth and says, you have one of ours. You have Kal-El. Kal-El, give yourself up or we're going to take it out on this planet of yours.
Right. So first half of this movie is I'm finding myself. Oh, you know, I have these powers and I'm keeping it a secret. The stakes, that's the fun and games of this, you know, learning to fly and all the ways Superman secretly saves people.
Right.
Right. But now we've got an alien from another planet hits Earth. He's taken over. He's taken out our military. He's like, I'm going to lay waste to the planet unless you give yourself up. And now Kal-El becomes Superman. And has to, you know, deal with General Zod.
Yep.
In the second half of the movie, the bad guys close in. You know, it's a lot bigger stakes. You know, humans may be dying. The planet may be dying.
Yeah. He's not just this legend.
Lois
Lane could die. He's not just this legend anymore. He has to come out into the sun and say, you know what, I am here among you. And you know, he actually goes and he lets humanity decide his fate at the beginning of this process, right?
Yeah.
Like so he actually kind of comes out. He knows who he is. Again, now it's a different game.
There's a ticking time clock because General Zod says, come out or I'm going to start, you know, hurting people.
Sure.
Also, we find out, you know, in the first half of the movie, Superman's invincible, right?
Yep.
But then when General Zod arrives with his people from Krypton, they're all as invincible as he is, and we find that they can hurt each other.
Yeah, so you've raised the stakes, and you've also found the thing that is going to allow the bad guys to close in later on.
Right, right?
Like
exactly.
The thing, the weakness that they're going to prey upon for the rest of the second act.
Okay, great. Yep. Star Trek Into Darkness, midpoint. Or what's the A story? What's the A story? For our protagonist, who is, it's got to be Kirk.
Well,
maybe it's Spock.
Dual protagonist.
Yeah,
thing.
Yeah, okay.
But you have to listen to the original podcast. We get really deep in that. But essentially, what it is it's this tale of terrorism and going after the terrorist or
right.
who we think the terrorist
very,
is.
Very simply, someone's blown up a building on Earth, and Kirk and the Enterprise are tasked with going to find him. He's on a remote. Planet. He's on the Klingon homeworld.
Just find him and take him.
Which is in the neutral zone. Which says there's some stakes there.
Right. There's some debate over what they can actually do.
If going at you know, Scotty doesn't want to be any part of it because they bring these sort of special weapons on board that they won't tell him about.
Right.
I think some. Who else questions the morality of it? Is this Spock question?
Spock question. Everybody's questioning the morality of it except for Kirk, right?
Yeah.
Like, and that's part of the debate. And then he finally gets over it, and they go try to do the right thing.
Kirk decides, he's like, okay, we're not going to go murder this guy. we're going to bring him to justice.
Right.
But still, the A story for the first half of the second act is we're going to go find this fugitive named Harrison.
Right.
And because he has blown up a building, and it's very simple, he's a terrorist. What's our midpoint?
Our midpoint is when we find out that Harrison is not Harrison. Harrison is Khan, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, so...
And he is not just a terrorist.
He's not just a terrorist. He has been woken up, from a sleep when the Federation has
been going out
looking to improve their military presence after Vulcan was destroyed, right?
Right.
So now this twists.
The same person who sent Kirk on the mission, right, which is
General RoboCop.
Admiral RoboCop.
Right.
Actually had woken Khan.
Right.
And for military purposes. And Khan just went, didn't like being used. He went rogue, and bombing the.
But he had Khan for a while, right? Yeah. Like he had Khan for a while, helping him ramp up the military, right? He helped him develop this new starship, right? The Vengeance.
Oh, right.
And the Vengeance appears. Vengeance appears.
That's kind of the midpoint.
It's at the same time that Khan reveals who he is. Like all this happens at once.
So what happens to the A story once Khan is revealed? It's not, the mission for Kirk is not just to get a terrorist back. Now what's the new mission?
The new mission is to... So the new mission, he has to team up with Khan.
Yeah, but to unravel the mystery
of what's going on with this military presence with this admiral who has gone rogue.
Starfleet itself, of which Kirk is, has allegiance to, is corrupt.
Right.
And he has to find out he wants to uncorrupt it.
Right. They're
on a war footing. They want to go to war with the whole universe because they're afraid from what happened in the first Star Trek movie.
Sure.
It goes from let's go get a guy, a terrorist. Let's go take the Enterprise and go get a guy. To I've got a big mystery here. I've got to team up with a guy who I thought was a bad guy.
I've got to save the Enterprise.
I've got to go up against a ship, the Vengeance, which is basically three times the size of the Enterprise. It's all the weapons the Enterprise doesn't have.
Right.
And I've got a bad guy in the Admiral RoboCop, and eventually Khan turns on him too, right?
Yeah.
So,
but you know that's going to happen.
Yeah, of course.
But at the midpoint, all these stakes are established. The Enterprise is now in jeopardy. Harrison is really Khan. The Federation or this admiral is ready to go to war, and that is against everything that the Federation is supposed to stand for. So Kirk's got
to
stop.
Right, they're supposed to be a peacekeeping and humanitarian armada.
Yep, we know all of that in that midpoint, in that like 5 to maybe 8 minute section of the movie, we learn all of this information.
Right,
and the movie changes.
It changes from like one A story has completely escalated. Yep. Okay, great. So I think we made some great examples of the midpoint. And the importance of the midpoint, because it really, as a screenwriter, your A story, your best stuff, you've got to save your best stuff for the second half.
Yeah.
And you've got to figure out how to get the fun and games to be interesting, the promise of your premise. You have to get some Star Trek and some Man of Steel, like great set pieces.
Sure.
In the first half, but then you've got to get your midpoint to turn it into a much harder problem to deal with and have some even better set pieces in the second half.
Yep. Yeah, you've got to have everything that goes in the trailer. You have to have everything that goes in the trailer in that first half of the second act, right? It has to be that good that it's going to eat up 2.5 minutes of trailer time.
And then you've got to do better.
And then you got to kick it in the ass.
And this is where movies fail. And this is the hardest part of screenwriting. When they always talk about the second act being the hardest part, yes, you've got to have not just escalating obstacles, but you've got to have a midpoint that twists it into a higher dimension of stakes.
And this, this is what makes strong screenwriters, right? Like there, I know a lot of people who are screenwriters who are filmmakers of some sort, and they moan about the fact that movies are horrible because everything is in the trailer, right?
Yeah.
Well, but this is your job, right? Your job is to make everything that goes in the trailer, all that marketing stuff that is your fun and games. And then your job is to do better in the second.
In the bad guys' closing.
Absolutely. That's on us.
And that, and you've got to work that through the midpoint. Okay, great job. If you guys want to listen to the script beat sheet editions, you subscribe to them the same way you subscribe to this main podcast.
Yep. Or you can do it on YouTube because these are all broadcasts.
That's right. We have a YouTube channel called under NYC Screenwriters Collective, and you can see me and Chris and whoever else is participating.
Follow us on Google Plus.
You can follow us on Google Plus, and yeah.
Yep.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, David.
Welcome to another 3 minutes of Baron's Corner. Wait, I know what you're thinking. 3 whole minutes? Are they insane? Could an audience possibly stay interested that long? Is the Baron the proverbial anvil in the picnic basket that will drag the rowboat to the bottom of the lake? I guess you'll just have to listen and find out. I do hope you're wearing a life vest. In regards to my last review before midnight, I still maintain that it was in fact a zombie film. You try watching that film and not getting the creeps. I'll have to ask the show's resident zombologist, if that's the word, about the rules for becoming a zombie, because after watching the film, I've been feeling a little funny. Which brings me to my special guest, Tina Fey. Mm. Tina didn't eat on the flight over from the Upper West Side, so I've had my man Henry set her up with a few of her favorite snacks. We'll just let her munch along there, and Henry, do bring her another napkin, please. The llama rug. Tina, let me ask you a question. How can one of the world's funniest, smartest, and sexiest women continually be entrapped by feature films that have none of these qualities? How? Wait, dear, you'll get a chance to speak. You'll get a chance. Try the Nutter Butters. That's right. Head writer for SNL, creator of 30 Rock, writer of Mean Girls, yes? Mm-hmm. Please explain Date Night and Admission, with special emphasis on Admission. I was sent by the show to review Admission earlier this year, and I'm only just now able to speak about it. Please, Tina, please stop saying yes to projects opposite adorable leading men. Adorable leading men are like kryptonite to comedy. Keep it up, and you'll end up both alive and dead at the same time, just like Jason Alexander. Miss Faye, I beg of you, please don't listen to those naysaying ninnies who claim you are only effective in the short comedy form. You just need a great script, that's all. And lucky for you, the Baron has prepared a brilliant one. It's just an outline form right now, but try to follow along. I think you'll be thrilled. Okay, ready? First, we start with a terrific premise, maybe even two genres that when you hear the title and story, you think, oh my, that should be spectacular. Film starts on you. We get to know you a little, and then something happens, and you get an opportunity to do something different. You're not sure at first, so you debate it. Maybe even a mentor or an old wizard counsels you. I don't know. Something terrible happens, and you decide, yes, I will take the opportunity. Now our film properly begins. There are a series of conflicts escalating to perhaps the middle of the film. Then there's a major setback, and you realize the provisions you've brought along will not sustain you. You get scared. But then the obstacles in your way get more and more intense, and we think, no way. No way can she make it. You are then, at some point, seemingly crushed by a big defeat, and you want to give up. You don't, though. You remember the advice from the old wizard at the beginning, and you put together a plan for victory. And that final battle should be so challenging, Tina, that we don't know how you'll make it. That's all I have so far. What do you think? What do you think? Pretty terrific, right? It's right. Am I right? What's that? Sure. It's a little abstract right now, but that's where you come in, Tina, to drape the skeleton with some of your signature comedic blood and sinew. I'm sorry about that. Here, try some of the Hawaiian punch. There you are. Well, my, I'm afraid we're all out of time. I'd like to thank my guest, Tina Fey. And to all of you, I say keep watching small films, and I'll see you soon in the Baron's Corner.
All right, on our next segment of the script, we're gonna be doing a TV segment. We're gonna talk a little bit about writing for television for screenwriters out there who are excited about writing for TV.
And who isn't excited about writing for TV?
I know, it's a very exciting time to be writing for TV. I wanna start off with the basics for any beginners out there and just get some terminology out of the way. Original pilot. This is when you write an original first episode of a series that is not yet on television, that's your original creation.
Would you say that it's not like a remake, like The Bionic Woman or Battlestar Galactica, something like that? Is it completely your idea?
Yes, it better be completely original. That's an adaptation.
Right.
Although if you decided to remake an original pilot of an old like episode that you don't have the rights to, it's just a spec. It's a spec and it's very...
Which leads us to the next kind of script.
Right. A next type is a spec episode, which is a sample episode of a television series that's already out there, right? That's on television.
Yes, this should be currently showing, in fact.
Yes, it should be on the air. It should be a hit. And it should be in the genre that you would like to be on the writing staff of if you're trying to get a job.
So don't write that How I Met Your Mother spec if you want to work on Game of Thrones.
Exactly. You need to write, if you want to write on sitcoms, you would write How I Met Your Mother, but you can't send your TV spec to the How I Met Your Mother people. You'll never work there. Only they can write those episodes. But you can write for other sitcoms like
Two and a Half Men, New Girl,
The Mindy Project, something like that.
Oh yeah, The Mindy Project.
So your spec episode should be spec episode and an original pilot and maybe a feature length screenplay is what people are looking for today. As if you're applying for jobs, trying to get managers to get your work out there, they want to see an original pilot, they want to see a spec episode, and they want to see some other work, maybe like an original feature.
Now, if you were doing an original pilot, would you add a Bible to that?
Sometimes. A Bible is an extended explanation of the universe that you've created, of the character backgrounds, possibly the outline
of a first couple of episodes. Even.
Well, even a season arc, you know, talking about if it's 10 episodes, season 12, whatever, what's the plot arcs for the season, some of the character arcs of the season.
Right.
But the Bible is not always asked for as a piece of writing material. The Bible is asked for if someone actually likes your original pilot enough that they want to buy it.
Right.
If you're trying to get a job on a writing staff, the original pilot and the spec episode and the feature episode are writing samples for you to maybe get a job on a TV show. Comedies are referred to as half-hour comedies, despite their length, right? Dramas are referred to as one-hour dramas, despite their length. Network dramas are 44 minutes. Cable dramas are about 60 minutes. Network comedies are 24 minutes. Cable comedies are 30 minutes. In drama, we have episodic dramas and we have serial dramas. Episodic dramas are self-contained episodes. Every TV, the story in each episodic episode is...
In episodic shows, there's an arc for the episode.
Yes.
It may not necessarily carry over into other episodes.
Right. It is resolved, it's self-contained in that episode of the show.
And I think if you look at even more modern TV shows that we would consider episodic, I think with modern tastes... they're not entirely contained anymore.
Yeah, they're usually, the episodic shows we have today are a little episodic, mostly episodic, a little serial.
It reminds me, I was reading about Hogan's Heroes a couple of weeks ago, and they shot those to be shown in any order.
Right,
so
that's interesting.
Continuity didn't matter.
Yeah, same with like Law and Order, right?
Right.
It's all about, episodic is all about not having... to have seen the episode that happened before it. And that works much better in syndication, okay? Then you have serial dramas like Game of Thrones, like Breaking Bad, where you need to know what happened in previous episodes to fully enjoy the current episode.
Right, you need to know what happened in season 1, episode 7 to understand the reference in season 4, episode
13. Every episode of a serialized drama does have a story arc that is resolved within the episode as well. So there's even more...
Taking us hopefully one step closer to the resolution at the end of the series.
The season arc.
I would say it depends, because series arc.
Because
if you look at Buffy the Vampire Slayer, it would be a season arc, whereas Breaking Bad, it's definitely a series arc.
Right. And then we want to have a little bit of a TV genre conversation later. So I want to stick with, go to comedy. There are multi-camera comedies, right, which are traditional sitcom formats, like The Big Bang Theory is a real popular one right now.
Three-camera and all that.
Uh-huh. And then you have your single-camera comedies that tend to be less formatted, stuff like Louie, like Weeds, Girls.
Mindy Project.
Yeah, sure. Okay. So those are the basics terminology for TV. Tonight we also want to have like a genre, TV genre conversation, okay?
If you insist.
Because I do insist. Thanks for going with me on this journey, Chris.
I guess so.
We're gonna have if you go into dramas, you've got generally what you call the procedural dramas, right?
Right.
Traditionally, the big three types of dramas that are proceduralized: legal, police, hospital. Now you also have the firemen, you know, first responders.
Right. That's a fairly new one since Rescue Me. I would say.
Rescue Me. Now we have Chicago Fire.
Chicago Fire, definitely. There have been a couple others, but I think the most successful has been Rescue Me, although...
Amazing show. Serialized drama.
So it's definitely a drama, you'd say. I'm not entirely familiar with it, so I couldn't...
Yes, no, it's a 1 hour. Okay, right, this is the thing that defined, and everyone must remember this. If it is 1 hour...
It's a drama.
It's a drama. If it is half an hour, it's a comedy. Okay, and we're going to get into that right now, because we have this... terrible, terrible term that annoys me to a great degree, but there is sort of a place to it, is the dramedy.
Yes.
Okay?
It's okay, David. You don't, you know.
I'm a little beside myself when people use the word, but in feature films, when somebody uses the word dramedy in a feature film, I'm throwing that out the window, okay? There is no such thing as dramedy in features.
Well, there goes like my next three, you know, scripts, man.
Dude, seriously. Okay? In television, a dramedy is kind of a term for a lighthearted 1 hour drama.
Right? Well, then what would you say about The United States of Terra? Because that was half an hour.
That's a half hour comedy. Half hour comedies that happen to have good amounts of drama in them.
See,
right? That's just good writing.
If I were looking at that as a full hour kind of thing, I would never classify it as a comedy.
Okay. But
don't get me wrong.
But it's funny. It's dark comedy.
Yeah.
United States of Terra, beautifully written show. It's a dark comedy. It's half an hour. Weeds, okay?
I dig it, man. But according to an article that both of us read,
okay,
the dramedy is easily defined.
What was the article? Do you have the notes on the article?
Yeah, I saw my cat. I didn't.
Okay, so thank you for that. We'll post it on the website.
It is posted on the website.
Okay, so... What did we take away from the article?
So the article basically said, and I think it was regardless of length of episode, because Ally McBeal, I think you could argue, was a dramedy, but it was an hour long.
Yes.
What defined it wasn't that it was completely comedy or completely drama. It was basically a comedy with raised stakes in thematic elements that you would find in a drama. So if you look at a traditional sitcom, three-camera sitcom, the stakes for their context might be high, but nobody's going to die of cancer.
Right.
Nobody's going to have to deal with multiple personality disorder. Nobody's going to have to deal with the DEA.
These are dramatic stakes you're talking about, not comedic stakes. Comedic stakes are, you know... Who's on first? I can't get this guy to understand what I'm trying to explain to him.
Right,
it's very funny.
I need a dress to go to the prom. I need to finish my homework. I have to, you know, whatever. It's a low stake. Whereas with a drama, in context, the stakes are usually much higher. So, crap. You have to deal with, you know, with higher stakes than, you know, who's going to go to the prom and things like that. And so if you look at like The Big C and Weeds and, you know, so on, those, I think if you're going to classify something as a dramedy, it is because it's a comedy kind of lighthearted situation infused with dramatic themes, higher stakes and so on.
In terms of screenwriting for television, if you write a half an hour show, you're going to be boxed into half-hour comedy. If you manage to get a good amount of drama into your half hour, that's brilliant writing. That's what you get on Girls. That's what you get on The Big C. Okay? You get a good drama in with your comedy format, and that's just great writing. And that's why the shows become more successful, because they're not just offering laughs. They're offering drama as well.
Didn't The Big C get canceled recently?
Yes, but it had a two-season run. So.
Which isn't bad. But all I'm saying is that it's like, maybe what I'm arguing is that sooner or later we're going to be throwing out, you know, oh, it's half an hour, so it must be a comedy. Oh, it's an hour, so it must be a drama.
But that's how they're consumed.
Oh, I understand that.
And that's how the networks will take your original work, right? And that's how, if you're trying to get a spec or an original pilot out there, that's how you're going to be looked at. So you have to just respect the formulas.
I totally understand it, but I think like we're looking at such a huge change in the way content is consumed. As of this recording, Orange is the New Black just came out all at once on Netflix.
Yes.
And Arrested Development came out all at once on Netflix and House of Cards and so on.
Right.
And Hemlock Grove. And so
But still, you can divide them into 1 hour dramas and half hour comedies.
And I would argue, and it's not going to happen soon, but we're going to watch that go away.
You won't see a 1 hour comedy. You know why? Because 1 hour comedy, good comedy.
It's half a movie.
Is that's a good point.
Yeah.
But 1 hour of comedy is good enough to cut into two episodes. So why would you waste it? Because people consume comedies in half hours. Okay. You have to think about the pellets with which the lemmings eat the food. Okay.
For example, I'm watching on Hulu Plus Zazie on the Metro. It's a Criterion Louis Malle flick. It's a comedy. It's an hour and a half long. I watched the first half hour about a week ago. I'm going to go back and probably watch a half hour
It's a
today.
Feature movie.
It's a feature film. Okay. Yeah. So what I'm saying in this little tête-à-tête is that the way we consume is very different. And so the hour-long whatever is going to be kind of meaningless in time. Because yeah. I'm going to watch the first half of, you know, episode 7 of House of Cards. I'm going to go make a sandwich. I'm going to go talk
to somebody. So the binge viewing experience is changing how we consume the pellet. But it does not change, as writers, it does not change the format that we're using when we're writing our original specs and our TV, our original pilots and our TV specs.
Right. No, and I agree with you, but you know, I think we're going to see things changing soon.
Absolutely, everything's changing. That's why we're talking about on our podcast. Two other things I want to talk about. We're almost done. Is you can loosely put a couple extra genres into drama. The main character driven. Drama.
Right, like Dexter.
Dexter, House, right?
Breaking Bad. Okay, because
surrounded around a single like gravitational force in the dramas, right? As opposed to an ensemble drama like Parenthood, where it's lots of characters, multiple stories, that kind of thing.
Now, with the ensemble, I think we are actually seeing something new, because I actually thought about this one when you sent me the email to do this. And I was thinking of ER.
Mm-hmm.
And despite, I think, his late entrance into the episode, I feel like despite it being an ensemble, there was kind of a main character with that. And it was John Carter, the Noah Wiley character.
Yeah, sure.
And it was one of those situations where there was a lot of drama around him, but everybody around him kind of knew who they were, what they wanted, and how to get it.
And it definitely evolved into more of an ensemble, but I think it began with him through his eyes. Yeah, John Carter was that way. But even an ensemble show like The West Wing, it began with Rob Lowe as the...
And he eventually left.
As the eyes, hold on, but the reason he left was because three seasons in, Rob Lowe was the protagonist, you might say, whose eyes with which we saw The West Wing, but right. About three seasons in, they shifted. Sorkin shifted it to be more through the president's eyes.
Right.
And then Rob Lowe got a pay cut got an increase that wasn't as much as everybody else, and that's why he left the show.
Well, to go back to ER, it was one of those things. It's one of those things where the reason I suggest that, despite it being an ensemble, there's still kind of a main character, is that when John Carter goes through and kind of becomes the head of the ER,
mm-hmm.
the show is pretty much over. I mean, we've seen this guy arc. However, Parenthood, from what I've seen of it, seems a little more mature as an ensemble, because whereas it seems most of the ensembles before had one character being influenced by other characters or one character influencing other characters, it seems a little more equal. All of the characters seem more than just two-dimensional.
Okay, but there is this genre of like main character driven and this ensemble.
Definitely.
And then there's this last thing I want to talk about, which they talk about, which is called prestige television. Okay? You've got shows that have a niche audience, a smaller audience. They're not getting the ratings that like Big Bang Theory or Two and a Half Men are getting.
Right.
But they bring prestige
to a network.
Something like Mad Men.
Right.
Right? Mad Men does not have high ratings.
No,
right?
If it was a network, it would probably be gone.
But it made AMC what it is today.
Right.
Right? You know, before Breaking Bad really caught on, the first couple of seasons, it's now a phenomenon. It gets huge ratings
right.
now. First couple of seasons, it could have been just prestige television. It was this show. It was some crazy show that's defining a network.
Well, I would say, you know, let's define prestige because it's, you know, quickly because it's like, I feel like some shows are built to be prestige, like Boardwalk Empire.
Absolutely.
The pedigree, I mean, Martin Scorsese directs the first episode, right. But Breaking Bad becomes prestige.
Sure, absolutely. Okay, but these, like, prestige television shows, they get the bigger budgets, they get the bigger actors, right, to anchor them.
Right.
And if you're writing, if you're writing your own original pilot, you should think about this. If you're thinking about bigger budget for your universe and your characters, okay, and you edge into the prestige area, that's a much harder sell.
Right.
Okay. Than writing, I got another funny sitcom with a twist on it and I'm a really funny guy.
So prestige might be something a little later in your career.
Maybe, but yeah. it does not mean your 1 hour dramas you should steer away from, like, really great universes and really great characters. I think maybe the main character driven original pilot is an easier sell. If you've got a more original main character driven drama, that's an easier sell.
Yeah, and it's easier, you know, in many ways to write because there's not as many strings to weave together, I think.
So we're gonna have a lot of information on the website. We've got a bunch of TV workshops at NYC Screenwriters Collective. If you're in New York City, you should come join us. We're doing TV a lot now. We haven't done a podcast on TV yet, but who knows?
We should.
So with that, thank you, Chris.
Thank you, David.
The Script is the official podcast of the NYC Screenwriters Collective. We are a community of New York City screenwriters engaged in a specialized script development process to enrich our member scripts and propel them to success in the business of writing for film and television. The Script is the best parts of our workshop. Our best script doctors, our hottest screenplays, our custom script development methods, and lively discussions on current events in the business of film and television. The Script is produced by Tawny Foskett and Chris Durham. You can email us fan mail, hate mail, comments, questions, or proclamations to scriptfeed@gmail.com. You can join our Facebook page or Google Plus page by searching for NYC Screenwriters Collective. You can follow us on Twitter @scriptfeed. If you live in New York City, sign up for our workshops at meetup.com under NYC Screenwriters Collective.